and that Goldberg could be the answer to Steve Austin as a super draw. The ovation he received when he won the belt was among the loudest anyone had ever heard. The TV ratings spoke volumes as well, as the quarter hour for the title change set a cable wrestling record, 6.91 rating with 5,054,000 homes turning in, helping Nitro win the night 4.93 to 4.0. And Bischoff no doubt smiled widely on Tuesday morning when the ratings came in. But something was lost in that ratings win. Money! And lots of it. The first ever Goldberg-Hogan match, which could have drawn millions of dollars on pay-per-view, was aired free on Nitro instead, owing almost entirely to the fact that Raw had kicked their ass the week before. Instead of showing patience, as he had with the Sting-Hogan bout, Bischoff allowed very lucrative business to be pushed aside because he wanted to brag that Nitro had won a week in a ratings war that he cared about more than any of the fans watching at home did. The title change, also a last-minute decision, effectively put the kibosh on several storylines that Hogan had been involved in that could have led to lucrative matches with Bret Hart and Kevin Nash. There was actually worse news than that, too. WCW drew 41,412 fans, the biggest crowd in its history, to the Georgia Dome to see the match. At the time, it was the fourth largest crowd ever to watch a wrestling show in the United States. You'd think that WCW would brag about this and likely even add to the figure, as it had always been common practice in the business to slightly exaggerate attendance numbers. Instead, however, they inexplicably subtracted 1,500 fans, announcing 39,919. Yes, WCW became the first promotion in wrestling history to claim a less impressive number than what they actually drew. It gets even worse than that. When they first announced Hogan versus Goldberg locally, they only sold about 2,000 extra tickets. Realistically, the company was still hot enough at this point that very few, if any, of the wrestlers could actually be considered ticket sellers. Instead, the name WCW itself sold tickets, usually on the very first day before a card was ever announced. The mainstream wasn't aware of this, however, so Hogan decided to manipulate it so that it would appear that he did, indeed, sell tickets pretty much on his own. Therefore, he suggested the idea of doing the match live on TV and switching the title. After all, if the match was televised, it would look like he drew the house, whereas if it wasn't, someone else could get credit for the new company record. And that would be completely unacceptable. Lesson not learned. The sheer amount of money WCW lost in rushing Goldberg Hogan to free television cannot be understated. But it hasn't stopped anyone from hot-shotting various angles and matches in an effort to pop what is essentially a worthless one-week rating. While it had nowhere near the ramifications of the Goldberg title win, the unmasking of Kane in 2003 comes to mind as another perfect example of something that could have been built up for months for a pay-per-view big-money match. In Mexico, matches in which a competitor is forced to show his face upon being defeated have drawn money for decades. Of course, these are generally done with a proper build. Instead, one week on Raw, it was casually announced that Kane would be battling Triple H for the title. If he lost, he would lose his mask. He lost. With no real build, the show didn't even gain viewers, doing the exact same rating as it had the prior week. And then, he just put the mask back on years later, again, with no real explanation. Oops. Hogan had one major demand, that when the time was right to beat Goldberg, he would be the guy to do it. Because he agreed to drop the belt with a clean pinfall loss in the first place, there weren't any problems with this scenario. He also, as usual, had a few diabolical tricks up his sleeve, to be revealed over the next several months. At the time the Goldberg-Hogan Nitro went down, no one really examined Hogan's motives or the long-term impact the title belt would have on the company. Instead, everyone was looking ahead to Bash at the Beach 1998, in which Hogan and Rodman beat Page and Malone after E. Harrison Leslie interfered. The show was a shining example of the good and the bad that go along with using celebrities. On the bright side, the match got WCW a ton of mainstream publicity, with everyone from Sports Illustrated to USA Today sending reporters to cover it. Plus, Rodman and Malone proved to be successful draws, as the show did the best WCW buy rate since Starrcade, an estimated 1.5 for almost a $7 million gross. For promoters who only look at the bottom line, that number alone was enough to convince them that they'd made a great decision. That's where the good news ends, however. Malone was very professional, and for a guy in his very first pro wrestling match ever, he was more than acceptable. Rodman, on the other hand, showed up in the infamous No Condition to Perform. You could argue that at least he showed up, because he'd blown off basketball practice to attend Nitro, and blowing off a wrestling show to attend, well, a party or something probably wouldn't have shocked anyone. In fact, he had disappeared for several hours the day of the show, and when he showed up in whatever condition he was in, the company was actually thrilled because they thought he wasn't going to be there at all. He got in the ring and was beyond horrible, screwing up moves left and right and actually falling down on several occasions. Then he tagged out, stood on the apron, and put his head on the turnbuckle, seemingly falling asleep. Luckily, that was the best role for him. Hogan had also demanded 45 minutes for the match, approximately 44 minutes longer than any of the four, with the exception of Paige, could realistically have wrestled and remained entertaining. Everyone, from the fans to the sports reporters who may or may not have ever watched a full wrestling show in their lives, knew it was an in-ring disaster. It should probably also be noted that despite no showing the last Nitro before the pay-per-view, showing up in a questionable state of mind, and doing nearly nothing in the match, Rodman still later sued the company for $550,000, claiming they defrauded him in contract negotiations. In light of all the publicity Rodman had been generating, WCW started to go overboard with celebrities, adding Kevin Green, actually a pretty decent wrestler given his level of experience, to the semi-main event. The idea was to tag him with Goldberg to face Hennig and the Giant. There was no logical reason for doing this, other than to waste a bunch of money on a guy who wasn't going to add one single buy to the show. Of course, this would be neither the first nor the last time that happened. There was a backstory to the Hennig vs. Goldberg match as well. A few weeks earlier, an idea was batted around where Hennig would attack Conan while he was having a match with Goldberg, and as a result, Goldberg would be declared the loser via DQ. Of course, this would have brought the streak to an end. By the grace of God, Bischoff axed that one, much to Hennig's chagrin. Looking back, it's frankly amazing that WCW didn't screw up the Goldberg push a lot earlier than they did. And Flair? Still on the sidelines, with WCW unwilling to bring him back to help in the war. Despite this, Flair suddenly found himself ranked number one in the online Time magazine Person of the Century poll, ahead of Adolf Hitler and Jesus Christ, among others. On July 17, the company came to terms with their next huge mainstream superstar, Jay Leno of The Tonight Show. Yes, that Jay Leno. If that wasn't sufficiently absurd, Bischoff spent an estimated $75,000 to construct a mock Tonight Show set so he could act as host of his own talk show during Nitro and Barry Leno. The first time they did this segment, it was so successful that it caused thousands of viewers to immediately switch channels to Raw. Eric, perhaps noting that Rodman and Malone meant nothing for TV ratings but did huge pay-per-view numbers regardless, decided to keep doing the segments despite their enormous turnoff factor. This resulted in a string of some of the worst first hours of Nitro in history. The original plan was to bring Leno, a huge motorcycle fan, in for a match at the annual Road Wild Biker Rally pay-per-view in Sturgis. So not only were they bringing in a non-athlete to compete in a worked athletic event, but they were also spending all that money to bring him in for a free show, meaning they wouldn't be making hundreds of thousands of dollars at the gate to help offset the cost of bringing Leno in. Obviously, they were hoping that all the free Tonight Show publicity would result in thousands of new viewers buying the pay-per-view. In July, the one-year anniversary of Bill Goldberg's first-ever win, the one that launched the famous streak and catapulted him to stardom, took place on Nitro. To commemorate the occasion, Goldberg, the company's world champion, remember, never once appeared on the show. The same show also featured the final match for several years of Ultimo Dragon, who after a botched operation by a WCW-appointed surgeon, was forced into retirement due to serious nerve damage in his left arm. He destroyed one of his students, Tokyo Magnum, in a match that was given, quote, a trillion stars by Figure Four Weekly, and long considered the greatest squash match of all time. In second place, by the way, was a match a year later featuring Chris Benoit and David Flair. Dragon went on to form his own training school and cult wrestling promotion in Japan, Toriumon, and over the next few years, he turned out some of the most exciting wrestlers the country had ever seen. Both shows set a new ratings record the following week, with Raw doing a 4.84 and Nitro doing a 4.72 for a combined 9.58 rating in 7,060,000 homes, meaning that approximately 10.5 million fans were watching wrestling at some point during the evening. This was the only good news for WCW, as Schiavone announced that their show, which actually drew almost 20,000 fans to the Alamo Dome, had drawn only 13,000. Meanwhile, the Raw show, which drew 12,000, was billed as having drawn 18,000 by Jim Ross. So everyone figured the WWF had the better night. To make matters worse, those who watched Nitro witnessed one of the most atrocious shows in its history. A show in which, over the course of 3 hours, exactly 19 minutes were devoted to actual in-ring pro wrestling. In fact, there was one match in the entire first hour, which ran less than 2 minutes. Meanwhile, Bischoff did another Tonight Show segment that went almost 20. At the top of the hour, starting the head-to-head battle with Raw, WCW presented a true Matt classic, Scott Norton versus Jim Neidhart, which went 16 seconds. No, that's not a typo, 16 seconds. Come to think of it, though, it was superior to those two going 16 minutes. They replayed the entire horrible Page and Malone versus Hogan and Rodman match from the pay-per-view, essentially telling everyone who bought it that they were stupid for doing so and had wasted their $30. At least the match got a good rating. Hogan also cut an amazing promo where he threatened to ride DDP's butt, then ride him hard and hang him up wet. Hall beat Sting. The NWO came down and destroyed Sting outside the ring. Instead of DQing Hall for the interference, the ref counted Sting out as he was being pounded on. The highlight of the show, sadly, was a tasteless angle with Steiner and Bagwell. Steiner pushed his buddy through the curtain in his wheelchair, then stopped on the ramp to flex. As he turned his back, the wheelchair rolled down the ramp and crashed into the ring. The look on Bagwell's face was priceless. Of course, he got right up and started flexing with the fans. The main event was Page beating Hogan via DQ, and yes, the NWO ran in. Still, Bischoff argued, the bout served its purpose by pushing the Road Wild pay-per-view. In legal news, Scott Hall was arrested for allegedly getting intoxicated and groping a 56-year-old woman outside a hotel in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Time for a pop quiz. WCW was so outraged by Hall's behavior that A, they suspended him without pay. B, they suspended him with pay. C, they turned the entire thing into a long-running angle in which Hall would come out on TV pretending to be drunk, stumble around in the ring, crash cars. In real life, he crashed 5 that year, and threw up on people. Hopefully, after reading this far, you won't be shocked to learn that the answer was C. The build towards Road Wild continued on the July 29 Tonight Show, when, during a skit with a fake Hulk Hogan, the real Hogan and Bischoff showed up and, quote, took over the broadcast for a minute or so. Leno finally returned with security and, coincidentally, Dallas Page, who helped run off the bad guys. Page then asked Leno to team with him to take them on at the pay-per-view, and Leno said, okay. None of this hype ended up meaning a thing for WCW's ratings yet, but on the bright side, Leno was totally kicking David Letterman's ass. Even though the two non-wrestlers in the match, Leno and Bischoff, were hardly in the same universe athletically as Malone and Rodman, The pay-per-view match was significantly better than anyone had any right to expect. The main reason was because Hogan did not ask for 45 minutes his time. Plus, he and Paige figured out that the best course of action was to have the non-wrestlers do almost nothing. Sadly, almost nothing did not mean absolutely nothing. And in a moment that is best forgotten, Hogan and Leno squared off with Leno actually getting the best of it. Leno locked an arm lock on the Hulkster that had old-timers claiming the business as they knew it was dead forever. On the plus side, if you want to call it that, there were probably 5 matches on the show worse than this one, although that's partly because those 5 matches were among the worst 5 of the entire year from any company worldwide. Steve Mongo McMichael versus Bryan Adams in particular almost set new standards. One could have argued that at Bash at the Beach it was okay for the world champion to work second to last, because the semi-main was a huge media event. However, Goldberg ended up working second to last on this show, as well in a 9-man battle royal that absolutely nobody cared about. While logic would suggest that Goldberg would be eliminated by a new challenger for his belt, he not only won, but he won decisively, last eliminating Giant in dominating fashion with a spear and jackhammer. There he was, the WCW World Heavyweight Champion, standing there with no challengers, no future programs, and playing second fiddle to, that's right, Hulk Hogan. The celebrity magic was gone, as the show only did in the 1.0 range, just slightly higher than what most pay-per-views from both companies had been doing. You would think that perhaps WCW would have learned a lesson from this, that A-list celebrities are only valuable when used sparingly. You would be wrong. And there was another lesson that should have been learned, but wasn't. WCW didn't have a full card for this pay-per-view until 6 days prior to the show. Normally, cards were announced far in advance, so there would be several weeks of television that could be used to promote them. Perhaps the mindset was that the company was so hot that they didn't need to announce anything other than a main event involving Hogan. It became a trend. The card wouldn't be announced until a week before the pay-per-view, and the buy rate would be low. This continued for months and months, and nobody internally seemed to put two and two together. The stupidity wasn't taking its toll on business yet, however. For July, the company grossed $4.3 million over 19 house shows, which made it the most successful month for any American wrestling company in history. Part of the reason that house shows were still doing so well was because many of the big stars were still working on them, including Goldberg, and WCW was doing their best to try to make the fans who bought tickets happy. In fact, when it was discovered that Bill wasn't going to make it on time to compete at the August 16 show in Providence, Rhode Island, WCW did something that was revolutionary. They told the fans that the show was free. That's right, they blew off a $146,000 gate, saying fans could either get a refund after the show or save their ticket to use the next time WCW came to town. On August 17 in Hartford, Connecticut, right in the middle of WWF country, former WWF champion The Ultimate Warrior made his WCW debut pretty much out of nowhere. Actually, literally out of nowhere, his gimmick was that he could appear and disappear at will in a cloud of smoke. Before we continue, we need to note that none of the following is being made up. This all actually happened, presumably because someone theorized that it would make fans buy tickets and pay-per-views. Prior to his arrival, WCW couldn't hype up Warrior's return like they probably wanted to because they were tied up in a legal battle over what they could call him. It was pretty clear that Ultimate Warrior was out of the question, since the WWF had that one trademarked, and you should have seen Eric's face when, on the August 24th Nitro, Hogan accidentally said, Ultimate Warrior. Just plain old Warrior seemed to be okay, though, mostly because that's what Jim Helwig, the man who played the Warrior character, had legally changed his name to. The WWF didn't even want him to wear his face paint, but he claimed he'd worn it when he worked in Texas as the Dingo Warrior at the start of his career. At the Hartford show, he was scheduled to talk for 6 minutes, but he ended up rambling on in a pretty much incomprehensible manner for almost 20, and the entire show had to be rearranged live as a result. Not that this was anything new for Nitro. It should be noted that the aforementioned ramble was by far the best interview of his entire career. The gist of his speech was that he was back, and he wanted to face Hogan again in an epic rematch from their first battle at WrestleMania 6 in 1990. In a comical moment, Warrior said that beating Hogan was no big deal, which kind of made one wonder why he would want to have a rematch with the Hulk. The interview was, as expected, a huge ratings draw. Nearly 7 million fans lost 18 minutes of their lives watching it. Warrior allegedly signed a $1 million deal to work roughly 3 shows per month, which of course had the locker room in an uproar, as nearly everyone else was making a hell of a lot less to work a hell of a lot more. And everyone but Eric Bischoff seemed able to predict exactly what the future held. Warrior would have a shelf life of about, 5 or 6 weeks, and then it would be all downhill from there. These people were sadly mistaken. His WCW shelf life was actually about 3 weeks. Nitro that evening also featured one of those only in WCW angles where you had to have a translator to make heads or tails of it. Eddie Guerrero came out and ranted and raved about Bischoff, then finished by pouring a cup of coffee on himself and saying he was saving Eric the trouble. You see, months earlier, Eric had gotten really mad backstage and thrown a cup of coffee against the wall by Eddie's head. What this had to do with wrestling and how anyone in the audience was supposed to know what he was talking about was never determined. A few months later, Eddie formed a stable of disgruntled Mexicans called the Latino World Order, or the LWO for short. Presumably, this was supposed to be his way of getting revenge on Eric for throwing coffee at him. Since the Mexicans had always been treated as total losers on TV, fans hated it with a passion, booing loudly, even as Guerrero ran down Bischoff and Hogan in promos. Many in the WCW hierarchy, however, honestly felt that it was a stroke of genius. This was the same company that had made over $1 million in 1 week. The week of August 24 was the stuff of legend. The two shows set a new combined ratings record, 9.72 in 7.169 million homes. Meanwhile, on ABC, the debut of Monday Night Football featuring a Green Bay Packers versus Denver Broncos preseason Super Bowl rematch did a 9.5 rating. Realistically, because network TV is in more homes than cable, football actually beat wrestling, 9.3 million homes, to 7.2 million. However, it soon became, quote, common knowledge, which you can read as urban legend, that pro wrestling was so hot that it was regularly meeting Monday Night Football in the ratings. Even at its peak, this was never really the case. But wrestling was legitimately hotter than a lot of other sporting acts and concerts, as evidenced by folks who tried to sell tickets to these events in classified ads over the summer. In the San Antonio market, for example, 75% of fans used Nitro or Raw in their bold headlines. WCW, the ads would begin, and then underneath it would read, yes, Elton John. The TV trend continued for the umpteenth week. Raw was great, and Nitro was horrible. On August 24, for example, the main event saw Goldberg and Nash beat Hogan and Giant when Goldberg speared and pinned Kurt Hennig, who wasn't even in the match. Also on the show, Chris Jericho went to a 10-minute draw with Kurt Hennig in 6 minutes, and then 3 nights later on Thunder, he beat Alex Wright in 12 minutes of a match with a 10-minute time limit. Sadly, nobody complaining about Nitro's quality could even fathom at the time that the following year it would get significantly worse. Short-term, Warrior was generating numbers, and it was beginning to look like another major ratings draw was coming back too, as Ric Flair, after being gone nearly 6 months, would likely return at the Nitro show in Greenville, South Carolina, on September 14. The WWF hadn't made him a serious offer due to their legal battles with WCW, plus some within the company, had been very vocal in expressing their belief that Flair was too old to come in and headline against Austin. Among those who argued against bringing Ric Flair back to the WWF was a young man by the name of Hunter Hearst Helmsley, who said outright in a radio interview that Flair should just retire. This was the same Triple H who 5 years later would end up best buddies with the still-active Flair on WWE television and would, in fact, write the foreword to Flair's autobiography. With Raw preempted for the annual U.S. Open tennis tournament, WCW's good fortune continued. Nitro drew a 6.03 in 4,485,333 homes, setting a new record for cable. Never mind that nearly 7 million people witnessed yet another installment in a seemingly endless series of hideous programs. This one, headlined by Sting and Luger, beating Hogan and Hart via countout. Afterwards, Warrior appeared in his cloud of smoke, a cloud now capable of making horrible wrestlers like Ed Leslie and Bryan Adams faint, and good wrestlers like Bret Hart vanish into thin air. Let us reiterate, this was designed to be compelling, not comical. Goldberg, the World Heavyweight Champion, again worked the semi-main, successfully defending his title against Kevin Nash's original tag team partner, a man named Al Green, who hadn't wrestled in what seemed like decades. Exactly how Al Green became the number one contender to the World Championship remains to be ascertained. September 14 saw a battle of the ages, as both sides put on pay-per-view caliber television shows with marquee matches and major character turns. From a wrestling standpoint, WCW presented one of its best TV matches of the year, with Billy Kidman winning the Cruiserweight title from Juventud Guerrera. From a marquee standpoint, Goldberg's first ever bout with Sting was a hugely anticipated matchup. On the other channel, the WWF turned both Rock and Mankind babyface. Undertaker made a strong heel turn, and Steve Austin faced Ken Shamrock for the first time ever in a WWF title defense. All of it, though, paled in comparison to the highlight moment of the year, the return of Ric Flair. His segment, which did a strong 5.4 rating going up against Mark Henry versus China and X-Pac, now that's some competition, opened with Arn Anderson coming out and cutting a great promo detailing the history of his career and that of the Horsemen. He called out Steve McMichael and Chris Benoit, then introduced Dean Malenko as the newest member of the group. At that point, he teased that the segment was over, and boy, were the fans ever unhappy about that. Truth be told, the whole thing almost fell through over the weekend, but Flair and WCW came to a new agreement on Sunday, and everything went forward as planned. "Oh, what a goof," Arn suddenly blurted. "What a goof. You know, I get accused of getting racked in the head a few times and have a little touch of Alzheimer's. My God, I almost forgot the fourth horseman. Ric Flair, get down here." It was a perfect setup. When Flair came out, he got an ovation that rivaled and probably exceeded any other ovation in the history of wrestling. An ovation that nobody watching will ever forget. After finally composing himself, Flair cut a promo, talking about his appreciation for the fans, his life in the past few months, and finally, Eric Bischoff. Eric showed up just in time to hear the following emotional outburst. "You're an overbearing asshole. You're obnoxious, overbearing, abuse of power. You, abuse of power, cut me off. Abuse of power, you suck, I hate your guts. You're a liar, you're a cheat, you're a scam. You're a no-good son of a bitch. Fire me, I'm already fired. Fire me, I'm already fired." And then they cut to a commercial, right in the middle of the speech that the majority of wrestling fans wish they could have personally cut on Eric. Thankfully, Flair's promo was so great that it took the minds of many fans off the previous night's Fall Brawl pay-per-view, yet another horrible show that the company actually charged fans money to view. There was one good match on the show, Saturn over Raven, and the main event was so atrocious that if you made a list of the very worst major main events in the entire history of the business, it would probably rank in the top 5 or 10. Dallas Page beat Hogan, Bret, Stevie Ray, Warrior, Piper, Sting, Luger, and Kevin Nash in a double cage War Games match. It seems unlikely that with so much impressive talent in the ring, a match could be this bad, but it was. Technically, there were two teams working against each other, but you wouldn't have known this to see it. Hogan came out with a device known as a slapjack, which looked for all the world like an old dirty sock, and knocked out everyone except Stevie. Neither man bothered to pin anyone, however. They just stood there looking at all the corpses. Warrior then appeared in his magical cloud of smoke. Hogan tore his jacket off, but then the smoke rose again, and when it cleared, Warrior was gone, and Hogan was left just holding the jacket. Warrior then ran out from the dressing room. Yes, they went to the trouble of hiring a fake Warrior, the artist formerly known as Renegade, just to do this cartoonish spot. Hogan, with help from Ed Leslie, escaped from the cage and locked Warrior in. Despite magically appearing and disappearing just moments earlier in his magical cloud of smoke, Warrior was now unable to get out of the cage. So he got angry, growled, and finally kicked his way out of the cage. They began to brawl in the aisle, and during this short melee, Warrior, despite having displayed no athletic ability whatsoever in this brawl, somehow managed to both twist his ankle and tear his biceps. Once everyone in the ring emerged from the smoke-induced coma, Page pinned Stevie with the diamond cutter. The crowd's reaction to this whole match took the form of intense and deep-seated hatred. "What an event!" Tony Schiavone screamed as the show concluded. Not only was the action in the ring becoming atrocious, so was the television production. In particular, the Thunder prior to this show featured one of the most unintentionally hilarious screw-ups ever. Chris Jericho had been spoofing Goldberg by going to the ring for his matches, accompanied by fat security guards, one of whom was a real-life ring crew worker who would go on to minor fame as Ralphus. The storyline this particular evening was that Jericho got lost trying to find his way to the ring and ended up locked outside the building. Unfortunately, the door didn't really lock, so when he pulled on the handle, it opened right up. He quickly closed it and pretended it was locked, pounding on the door and screaming to be let inside. Apparently, someone inside thought he was really locked out, because a door about 10 feet away opened, and this dude stuck his head out. Jericho had to pretend like he didn't see him. It gets better. His opponent, Wrath, got sick of waiting in the ring and ran backstage to find Jericho. They did a chase scene outside the building. Finally, they figured the camera was shut off, so Jericho stopped, and Wrath ran right past him. Then, they both turned and nonchalantly started walking back towards the camera. Problem was, the camera was not off, and this whole fiasco was broadcast to millions. Referee Billy Silverman was also having problems on Thunder. One week, he counted 3 during a Psicosis versus Saturn match when it was supposed to be a 2. Since the show was live, millions of fans witnessed Saturn and Psicosis looking at each other in complete confusion, then just giving up and walking to the back. A week earlier, Jericho was supposed to beat Jim Neidhart with his Lion Tamer submission. He tried to roll Neidhart over, but it just wasn't working. Neidhart said he gave up. Silverman didn't hear him. So Neidhart, in great discomfort, rolled out of the hold. Jericho, irate, told Silverman to ring the bell. Silverman actually said he couldn't ring the bell because he hadn't heard Neidhart submit yet. So Jericho said something along the lines of, "Wrestling is fake, you jackass, now ring the bell!" The string of horrible programming continued the next week on Nitro, with an angle in which Warrior, using his magical cloud of smoke, not only kidnapped E. Harrison Leslie, but instantly teleported him from the ring to the rafters. To accomplish this feat, they had Warrior in the rafters hugging a blow-up doll dressed like Leslie, one of the more surreal visuals fans would ever see. It was never explained how any of this was intended to sell tickets. Later, to further hype the Hogan vs. Warrior match planned for Halloween Havoc the following month, Hogan was brutally attacked by E. Harrison Leslie. The rest of the show featured only slightly more logical, yet ultimately inexplicable booking. It was said that the man partially responsible for all this warrior malarchy was former child star Jason Hervey of Wonder Years fame, who had become good friends with Bischoff. The next week wasn't as bad overall, but they did present one incomprehensible segment where Billy Kidman, who seemed to be a superstar on the rise following his cruiserweight title win over Hoovy, lost to Scott Hall clean in a totally one-sided match. Scott Hall was arrested again the following week for allegedly causing $2,000 in damage by King A Limo outside the Diamond Mine Strip Club in Orlando during a drunken fit. This led his ex-wife, Dana, to post a message on an NWO fan site, basically taking WCW to task for still employing him when he obviously had some serious issues to deal with. WCW was so outraged by Hall's behavior that they continued to portray him as a drunk on TV. As nonsensical as all the previous Warrior segments had become, however, nothing could compare to the October 5 Nitro, which showcased quite possibly the most absurd angle in wrestling history. The idea was that Hogan couldn't find Leslie, so he was searching for him throughout the building. He ended up in Leslie's dressing room, and in the mirror he imagined that he saw the Warrior. As he was screaming at this vision, Bischoff walked in. He could not see Warrior, however, and thought Hogan was going crazy. This is all fine and dandy, except for the fact that viewers at home could see Warrior in the mirror. Of course, this would mean that Hogan was not, in fact, crazy, but that Bischoff was. Or, Bischoff was right, and the fans were crazy, too. But then, to confuse matters, the Warrior in the mirror disappeared. But Hogan could still see him, which basically meant that everyone involved, from Hogan to Bischoff to the fans, was crazy. In the end, it didn't matter if they were crazy or not, because fans in the arena were booing like crazy. Lesson not learned. You just heard that paragraph about Hogan and Warrior in the magic mirror, right? Did you ever think anyone would want to bring that magic mirror skit back? Unbelievably, WWE did just this in a Randy Orton vs. Undertaker feud in 2005. Not only did Orton see Undertaker in a mirror, as did everyone else at home, but his father, Bob Orton Jr., also began bleeding for no reason. So, in addition to bringing back a horrible WCW gimmick, they also reenacted an awful WWF one as well, as voodoo master Papa Shango did the same thing to the Ultimate Warrior in the early 90s. In all honesty, we're not sure which is worse, or why WWE decided to bring the magic mirror back one more time in 2014, as John Cena saw a sheep mask, presumably Eric Rowan, in the mirror during a feud with Bray Wyatt, which then miraculously disappeared. Again, all of this was done in WCW, and it was horrible, and it's never been good since. Why this bit continues to be recycled will forever remain a mystery. And this was becoming a very bad trend. Instead of the good heat that the NWO had generated a year earlier, this was bad heat, the kind of heat that results in fans feeling ripped off, angry, and annoyed. Some crowds even began to chant, "Nitro sucks!" Seemingly everyone knew that the ship was sinking at this point, with the exception, of course, of those steering it. The next week, fans witnessed the continued rise of a new star. Judy Bagwell, Buff's mother. They'd flown her in months earlier to do cameos with her son, and everyone soon learned where young Marcus got his ego from. The week prior, she got in a huge pop dragging Bagwell to the backstage area by his ear, and apparently superstardom went to her head. This week, she'd gotten a total makeover and considered herself part of the show. Unfortunately, she didn't realize that her part in the show was to act sad when Scott Steiner turned on Buff and dropped him neck first over the top rope. Instead, she laughed, right there in front of the camera. On the October 19 Nitro, Chris Jericho did an interview, basically challenging Dallas Page to a match, which most astute fans found confusing, since in the weeks prior he'd been gunning for a match with Goldberg. As it turned out, Goldberg, being very green to the business, was taking advice from the wrong people, namely men like Hogan and Nash. He was told point blank that Jericho was way too small to feud with, and if he did so, it would kill his credibility. He told Bischoff to nix the program, and that was the end of that. At the moment, it was just another example of WCW putting the brakes on the ascension of someone who could potentially become a major breakout star. It was even worse over the long haul. Wrestlers were often told the sky was the limit, but young guys would start a climb toward the top, and then, right when they were starting to get hot, something would happen and their rise would be derailed. Guys referred to it as hitting their heads on a glass ceiling. Jericho, frustrated with hitting his head time and time again, refused to re-sign his WCW deal and jumped instead to the WWF. Despite being smaller than the guys Vince McMahon traditionally pushed as superstars, he was given the main event treatment on his very first day, sparring head-to-head with The Rock in a tremendous Raw moment. But then, a few months later, following a feud with Triple H, he was back to hitting his head on another glass ceiling, this time in the WWF. Years after that, when Goldberg first arrived in the company, Jericho, who had not forgotten about their WCW program getting axed, confronted him about it, and they got into a brief altercation backstage. Jericho, son of hockey star Ted Irvine and a former hockey player himself, grabbed the much larger Goldberg in a front face lock before everything was broken up. Because Goldberg liked to talk about his mixed martial arts training and had a reputation as a tough guy, and because so many people were bitter about the money he was making, Jericho became a hero to much of the WWE locker room. Nitro's main event that evening was interesting. Conan and Luger and Nash were wrestling Hall and Stevie Ray and Norton. If you'll recall, fans were more than fed up with Nitro matches ending abruptly when guys ran in to interfere. So, WCW had the ingenious solution of ending this match abruptly without anyone running in. That's right. They were having the match, and then the bell just rang, and it was over. Again, fans were outraged. And don't forget this chapter's early lesson. When things are hot, promotion can seemingly do no wrong. A few weeks after this debacle of a show, they put tickets on sale for December's Astrodome and TWA Dome Nitros. As vocal as fans were in their dislike for most Nitros, they still purchased 16,000 and 18,000 tickets respectively on the first day they went on sale. Halloween Havoc the following Sunday just about set new standards for everything. It almost felt as if the company was trying to see how bad a show they could put on that people would still pay to see. The Hogan vs. Warrior rematch was so far beyond atrocious that it actually made their War Games match look like a Ric Flair vs. Ricky Steamboat classic. The bout went on for nearly 15 minutes, and it is no exaggeration that these two 40-plus-year-old men could realistically only go about 15 seconds. Without question, the highlight of the match was a truly ridiculous spot that looked as though two kindergartners were on the playground. Remember when you were in preschool and you learned how to do the log roll? The one where you lie on your back and just roll over and over sideways? Well, Hogan tried to drop an elbow on Warrior, but Warrior log rolled out of the way. Hogan decided to try again, and again, Warrior log rolled out of the way. Suddenly, and I can only imagine the time that went into plotting this spot backstage, Warrior reversed direction and began to roll towards Hogan. You'd think that Hogan would have several options at this point. Step to the left, step to the right, or perhaps jump. Instead, he seemed stricken with fear because he just stood there as Warrior rolled right into his legs, making him fall down. Before he'd agreed to do the job to Hogan at Havoc, Warrior had also demanded that a new contract pick up where his first one had left off. WCW used him on TV less than a handful of times afterwards, so they basically paid him $1 million to agree to lose to Hogan and kill this feud off. If that wasn't bad enough, a spot was planned for later in which Hogan was supposed to throw fire at Warrior. In wrestling, fire is created by lighting a piece of flash paper. In the corner, Hogan poured his fire-making paraphernalia out of a Ziploc baggie. Warrior came at him. The audience, surely on the edges of their seats, then witnessed Hogan throw a piece of flash paper at Warrior. You read that right. He forgot to light it on fire. The fans who had been chanting, "Warrior sucks," and cheering Hogan earlier, booed loudly. Hogan tried again. This time, the paper lit on fire, but it ignited in his hand and burned out. Hogan looked terrified. Warrior was terrified too, and didn't know what to do. Finally, Hogan's real-life wrestler nephew, Horace, ran in and hit Warrior with an incredibly weak chair shot, which Warrior sold like he'd been shot with a handgun. Hogan dove in to get the pin. Afterwards, he told Horace that he'd passed the test, which begs the question, how bad could the match have been if he had failed? Lesson not learned. After bringing his nephew Horace in, and it being, well, not so grand, you might think that Hulk Hogan would avoid being associated with other members of his clan on national television. Instead, in 2012, his daughter Brooke showed up on TNA Impact as the, quote, executive in charge of knockouts. The role consisted of standing approximately 3 feet taller than any other woman, and many of the men, on the roster, being involved in top storylines with the lead characters in the company, and being unable to deliver lines properly or contain her laughter when things went wrong on air, which was pretty much weekly. Say what you will about the Hulkster, but he is nothing if not a family man. Much more damaging than the Warrior-Hogan fiasco, however, was the fact that WCW had decided, just a few days before the pay-per-view, that they were going to go 3.5 hours instead of the usual 3. Fans at home were not alerted to this fact and grew concerned at about the 2-hour-and-45-minute mark as Hogan and Warrior were still in the ring, and it didn't appear that Goldberg versus Page for the WCW title was going to happen anytime soon. To make matters significantly worse, nobody bothered to tell the cable companies, because at 11 o'clock p.m. Eastern, 25% of the folks who had purchased the show suddenly found themselves looking at a blank screen. Local outlets were flooded with angry phone calls, and had to struggle to come up with some sort of offer to placate the fans, most of which demanded full refunds. When all was said and done, it is estimated that WCW lost almost $1.5 million in pay-per-view revenue because of this simple miscommunication. In a dilemma about what to do, WCW decided to air the Page vs. Goldberg match for free on Nitro the following evening. Cable industry was not cool with this, because a replay of the pay-per-view was scheduled to air Tuesday night, and they figured airing a match on free TV would kill Tuesday's buy rate. WCW agreed not to air the Warrior vs. Hogan match for free, possibly the smartest thing they'd done in 10 years of business. Despite having aired the Bash at the Beach main event 3 months earlier on Nitro, announcer Tony Schiavone, who was losing credibility with the fans on a weekly basis, claimed that this would be the first time in history that a pay-per-view match was ever shown on free TV. Goldberg vs. Page went shockingly well, not only in the ring, but also in the ratings. Its quarter hour on Nitro set yet another new cable viewership record, a 7.18, beating out the Hogan vs. Goldberg match from the Georgia Dome in July. The rating helped win the night, as Nitro did a 5.06 to Raw's 4.48, which, despite the loss of $1.5 million the night before, no doubt made Eric Bischoff very happy. Hype began for their next pay-per-view, World War III. Having learned nothing from past mistakes, they announced no matches, save for one that bombed every year previously, a 3-ring, 60-man battle royal. It was somewhat fitting for WCW to run a pay-per-view using 3 rings, In early November, former wrestler and commentator Jesse Ventura was elected governor of Minnesota. Hogan and Ventura had been professional rivals for years, and now Jesse had finally accomplished something that Hogan could only dream about. Hogan, however, was undeterred and announced on Nitro that he was running for the President of the United States. The show ended up being crushed by Raw, with the WWF's biggest winning margin in history, a 5.03 to a 4.06. Worse, Hogan's segment was beaten 4.3 to 4.1 by Raw's Val Venus versus Steve Blackman in a battle of lifetime mid-carders. This was a super big blow for Hogan because he didn't attend the prior week's show and it was beaten in the ratings, and he wanted to convince people that his absence was the reason for the decline. This sure put an end to that theory in a hurry. Things were starting to implode fast. World War III was coming up, and on the last Nitro before the pay-per-view, they announced 0 new matches. All that was known was that there was going to be the traditional, horrible three-ring battle royal and a Scott Hall versus Kevin Nash match. Apparently, nothing else was important. 0 had changed on the TV, meaning it was still horrific most weeks. The same old guys were on top, having the same horrible matches. Actually, that's not entirely true. There was one new superstar that was pushed right to the top. Judy Bagwell became one half of the World Tag Team Champions with partner Rick Steiner. No, we're not lying. Raw clobbered Nitro in the ratings, 5.50 to 4.25. Nitro had settled into a pattern of finishing a point or so behind Raw every week. As you can imagine, Bischoff was not pleased and decided that changes needed to be made, and fast. Unfortunately, these changes had nothing to do with fixing the atrocious shows the company was presenting. No, a completely different plan was in the works. The time was right, he believed, to beat Goldberg. Actually, that had been the plan for a long time. Hogan would drop the strap to Goldberg at the Georgia Dome, then he'd win it back at Starrcade. But somehow along the way, there was a change in plans. Perhaps you're thinking that the change in plans was for Hogan not to beat Goldberg after all. Perhaps you're thinking that Goldberg was such a good ratings draw, house show draw, and merchandise seller that it would have been foolish to take the belt from him and put it back on Hogan, whose drawing power had waned over the past several months. You would be wrong. The change of plans was to have Goldberg drop the title not to horrible wrestler Hogan, but to horrible wrestler Kevin Nash. Nash had just been named new head booker for the promotion, and once this happened, everything backstage went into disarray. It went into disarray for fake reasons, however, not real reasons. Confused? Basically, Nash, Hogan, and Bischoff came up with a scenario to work all the boys. No, not to work the fans in an effort to make money, but to work the boys in, well, an effort to make them not so miserable. You see, pretty much everyone on the undercard hated Hogan. They saw him as a guy who was past his prime and needed to step aside to make room for new stars. Nash, however, was such a great politician that everyone liked him. In fact, no matter what he did, you'd be hard-pressed to find a person backstage who didn't think he was a really cool guy. So the plan was to give Nash the booking position, and Hogan, quote, outraged with his loss of power, would pretend to quit. He'd disappear for a while, Nash would make everyone happy, and morale would improve. Of course, the long-term plan was to eventually bring Hogan back and put the belt on him again. And also, Hogan needed time off to film Muppets in Space. And of course, we're serious. So Nash got the book, and as most bookers do, he began to write storylines designed to make himself the center of attention. His main idea was to set up his own big win over Goldberg for the belt at Starrcade. Step one was to put himself over in the three-ring number one contender battle royal at World War III, a show that ended up better than expected seeing as it was expected to be the worst ever. Step two was to book himself as a man who ended win streaks. Coincidentally, there was a man on Nitro who had been on a win streak lately and was starting to get over. His name was Wrath. He fell to Nash in 4 minutes and 45 seconds the next night. That was the end of him getting over. Step three was to build Goldberg up as a monster. After all, there's nothing cool about beating a nobody. If you're going to beat someone, you might as well beat a monster. This was accomplished by a 1 minute and 34 second victory over Giant on Nitro the next evening, which was also done because everyone figured Giant would jump to the WWF when his contract expired in February. Step four was to write wacky storylines for many of the mid-carders, stories that might not always play out, but that would at least make the guys feel like they were being utilized. Not all of the mid-carders were happy, though. A few whose contracts were coming due and hadn't yet re-signed were booked to lose left and right on TV. Nobody was safe, it seemed, except two men, Rick and Scott Steiner. For whatever reason, they were booked in a positive manner on television all the way up until the last week before their contracts came due. In the long run, it didn't matter because they re-signed. But internally, the belief was that they weren't booked to lose constantly because nobody had the nerve to go up to them and let them know. Scott, in particular, had become super scary, somehow having managed to develop a Herculean physique despite the constant travel and always seeming on the verge of bursting into a violent, unscripted rage. In fact, the following week, Steiner was in court on charges of making, quote, terroristic threats against a Georgia Department of Transportation worker named Paul Casperine. It seems Mr. Steiner was driving his F-150 down the road one day and came upon a closed lane. He told Casperine he wanted to go. Casperine said no. So Steiner said if he didn't get out of the way, he was going to run him over. Casperine refused, so Steiner bumped into him twice with his vehicle. That was the dreaded terroristic threat. Even the judge found this absurd, though he didn't like Steiner's courtroom attitude, and pulled an early plea bargain bid. Steiner ended up pleading guilty, and in March 1999 was sentenced to 10 days in prison, $25,000 in fines, 7 years probation, and 200 hours community service. It is tough to imagine what sort of community service Scott Steiner did. Part two of Hogan's long-term, two-month plan was to go on The Tonight Show and simultaneously announce that he was running for president and retiring from wrestling forever. Apparently, he was of the understanding that the American people would not want a man in office who devoted several days per month to having horrible matches on WCW television. It would only be the third time he had retired forever from wrestling, which isn't too bad when you consider guys like the legendary Terry Funk, who retired and unretired so many times they eventually lost count. Hogan was asked a few hardball political questions, like whether he was a Democrat or a Republican, and he had devoted so much time and research to his campaign that his answer was, "Right now, I'm right in the middle." "What kind of a lame answer is that?" Leno asked. Most saw Hogan's retirement for what it really was, a carefully orchestrated political maneuver that would benefit exactly one person in the long run, himself. Say what you will about Hogan, but few in the history of wrestling have proven so many times over how adept they are at playing the game. Hogan had taken himself off TV at many times when it was pretty clear the ratings were about to drop. For example, earlier in the year when Nitro was being preempted for the NBA playoffs. Obviously, he later stated that the reason things tanked was that he was gone, thereby increasing his perceived value. In late November, WCW finally figured out why buy rates had been dropping over the past several months and took steps to rectify the problem. They had the small wrestling online website shut down because the site owner had been doing pay-per-view play-by-plays on IRC. Strangely, buy rates did not return to previous levels. The November 30th Nitro once again told the story of why the company was about to fall off a cliff. they were still able to sell tickets. That wasn't an issue. In fact, Nitro drew their second largest crowd ever, 32,076, to the Astrodome in Houston, which, between gate and merchandise, made them almost $1 million.